Carly, I don't know if that's so good, you know. It kind of dates a person when they ask them to speak on the history of the navigators. It kind of puts you back in the Middle Ages somewhere. Well, I'll clarify this point. Jim Downing and I are not contemporaries. I was a high school kid when he was one of the early navigators. So I got to defend myself a little bit. You know, about a year from now, I don't think it'll be necessary to talk about the history of the navigators because, you know, Betty Skinner's been writing a book on the life of Dawson Trotman, and it'll go into a lot of this, and I hope it'll be out by next fall. It's in its final stages. So, you know, you put your little order in for that book, and you'll have the scoop straight from the, well, horse's mouth, I guess. Betty is the historian, really, of this outfit because she's done a lot more research. I just happened to be around when a lot of this was happening, and this was thrilling to see it. Well, I guess we might as well get into it. You know, this is one of those things that you can stretch or make small or do whatever you want to with. You could go on for hours, I guess, talking about history and not only history, but telling war stories and interesting things. It's said that an institution is the length and shadow of a man. And I think this is true of any movement as well, whether it's a political, religious movement or whatever. Usually, well, the movement today is much more than the man that started it. But if it were not for a man with a vision, usually these movements or institutions or whatever would not be in existence. And, of course, this is very true of the navigators. It began with a man, Dawson Trotman. And actually, this is really the history, you know, of the Bible. You've heard this, I know, and know this. But the Bible is really an account of what God has done through people, through men primarily, but also women in the Bible, right from the very beginning. And, for instance, just take Adam. You know, the whole human race has been affected by Adam, very definitely. Or take the Jewish nation and all of its history and the complexity of it all. Well, it started with Abraham. And Abraham really set the tone for a lot of the whole Jewish history and the promises God gave him and so forth. And you can trace this on down through the Bible. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Dawson Trotman. Dawson Trotman was born in 1906 in a town of Bisbee. How many know where Bisbee is? No takers? These Hoosier hotshots don't know their Western history. Bisbee is in Arizona. It's a little mining town almost down on the Mexican border. Yeah, probably like Tombstone or, you know, one of these kind of things where they shoot them up. Well, that's where Dawson was born. His father was an Englishman from the Isle of Man. You know, that's that little island between Ireland and England. And his dad was a small, wiry type person, a flamboyant, restless person. And he wanted to get away, I guess, from this more or less staid English atmosphere. And he came out to the West. He was a cowboy. He did some mining. He was a cook. He ran his own hash house down in Bisbee. He ran a general store. Just a little bit of everything out in the West. His mother was from New England, and she was quite the opposite. She was more reserved and humorless, and she was a perfectionist. Now, Doss got a lot of his qualities, of course, from both. His wiry, flamboyant, extrovertish personality from his dad, the perfectionist from his mother. Now, his father was nominally reared in the Church of England, but really had no religious conviction or belief. As a matter of fact, there was a man that profoundly influenced him, an atheist by the name of Berkeley Dawson. And he named Dawson after this atheist friend of his, Dawson Trotman. Now, his mother became a Christian, and she was, as I said, reserved, but she got involved in a very emotional type of Christianity. And so there was a real kind of a contradiction here. Here we had this person reared in a very staid type of Christianity, but he was an extrovert, outgoing person. The mother, who was very reserved by temperament, but was involved in a very emotional type of Christianity. The home was rather hectic, I must say. There was a lot of bickering, a lot of nagging, and this type of thing, because Dawson's father was not a Christian, his mother was. But Dawson often said, and I heard him say this many times, he said, if people would observe my parents and I'd ask them, which one's a Christian? They'd probably say, my dad. And because his mother apparently loved the Lord and prayed much for Doss, as a matter of fact, I'm sure that his conversion was to a great extent an answer to her prayers. And yet, the type of life she was living and all did not attract Dawson. It was not a consistent type of thing. It was rather emotional, as I said. Dawson had an older sister and a younger brother. And it's very interesting to note that his younger brother was killed rescuing a girl in a very similar way as Dawson was killed. They were out hiking up in the mountains in California, and somehow she got onto a ledge or slipped down and was hanging on to, you know, a little bush or a tree or something, and he tried to rescue her and he went on over the cliff. It's quite interesting in my background because our family happened to know the family of the girl. They were older than I was a little kid, but I remember when this happened that, of course, I had no knowledge that this person was Dawson Trotman's brother. I didn't even know who Dawson Trotman was, but I knew the incident happened when I was a little kid out in California. At age 11, the family moved to California, to the little town of Lomita, a southern suburb of Los Angeles. Now, Dawson was, we said, small. He was a 2.5-pound preemie, premature baby. He did have a weak heart, but he was an extrovert from the word go. He was a leader with real charisma, you might say, and this was from the beginning. For instance, he was a show-off. He'd go riding down this little town, this middle of the street, sitting on the back of a Model T Ford steering with his feet and all that kind of stuff, just to draw attention. You see pictures of him back in grade school, the band and all. There was Dawson right in the middle of everything. Everything revolved around Dawson because he was this type of a leader. He was a student body president, and he had ways of directing rallies, school rallies, so that they were models. And other schools would ask around, you know, how do you do these things? By the way, he was not a dummy either. He was valedictorian of his class. And his valedictorian speech was on morality versus legality. And while he gave that speech, he was stealing from the school funds. But this shows you the contradictions that were going on in this fellow. Now, after high school, I don't know why exactly Dawson didn't go on to college, probably because his folks really didn't have all that much, or he didn't have the inclination or the interest. But he got a job in a big lumber yard there in Southern California, driving one of these great big carriers that would go around a bundle of lumber and haul it around, you know, and dump it. And even from those early days, and then I remember later, any kind of a car or a motorcycle, Dawson just loved to race them, and he could handle things. He could control things very well. He'd do this with the big carrier in this big lumber yard. He got into a gang at the pool hall gang, and he got involved in gambling and drinking. And by the way, this was the time of prohibition. If you studied a little history, you know what prohibition was, where it was forbidden legally to have alcoholic drinks in the country, but of course you could get them illegally. And he got in with this wrong gang. And in 1926, and he was 20 years old now, he had gotten a little too much, and he was down on the pike in Long Beach, and a cop got him for disturbing the peace. I never did ever find out exactly what he did. He said one thing, he embarrassed a lady. What he did, I don't know. But this cop got him and was taking him to jail. And just the night before, Dawson's mother, who, by the way, was very ill and dying of cancer, she knew Doss was getting into trouble. He'd been sought by the law 4 times for minor stuff that year. And she said, Doss, if I ever hear that you're in jail, it'll kill me. And he knew it would. And so here he is on his way to jail on the hand of a big cop. And so he prayed, you know, as many do, the foxhole kind of prayer. Lord, if you get me out of this mess, because Mom said, and I know it would really be the end for her, I'll seek you, or this type of thing. Well, a few months before, Dawson had been in a similar situation. He was up in the mountains in California there. I think it was Lake Arrowhead or Big Bear. And it was night. There was swimming, bunch of them. He was out with a gal swimming in the night. She was out in the middle of the lake, and she started to go down. And he was trying to hold her up, and this is quite reminiscent of what happened in later years. And he prayed there in the black of the night, "Lord, you know, help us here, and I'll seek you or serve you," and this type of thing. And just then a boat came by and picked him up. But he forgot it in just a short while. Well, he remembered that he had made this commitment to the Lord a few months before, but this time he did his best to keep it. And that was a Friday. So as they were walking along, the cop looked down at him and he says, "Young man," he says, "do you like this kind of a life you're living?" He says, "No, sir, I hate it. I'd change if I could, but I can't." And anyhow, the cop seemed to have kind of a pity on him, and in answer to prayer, no doubt. And so he said, "Look," he said, "here's a park bench here." He said, "You sit down." And by the way, Doss couldn't find his car. He didn't know where it was. He said, "I'll be back in an hour or two." And he says, "If you can find your car, I'll let you go." And so Doss found his car, and he was released. Well, that was Friday. So Sunday, the only thing he knew to do was to go to one of the local churches there. It was Sunday evening. He went into the youth meeting. Now, here he knew all these kids from high school because he was very popular and well-known. Here comes Doss into this youth meeting. And this youth meeting in this particular church was run by two maiden lady school teachers. Both of them had had Doss in their classes, and Miss Mills and Miss Thomas, and they'd been praying for Doss daily for 5 years. And here he walks in. Well, they were just starting a contest in this youth group. And it was one of these deals where you get a lot of points, and after a few weeks, you know, the side that won would get treated to a party by the other side. And there were points, you know, for bringing visitors, for bringing your Bibles, etc. And there were also points for learning some Bible verses. And they gave them 10 Bible verses to memorize. And so Doss said, "Well," he said, "you know, here I'm starting out a new life somehow." And he said, I didn't want to be the only one that didn't know these verses. So he said he learned the 10 verses the next week. And by the way, this was only a Sunday thing with him, because during the week it was the same old pool hall gang and all the rest at the lumber yard. But next Sunday he came along. He came to the youth meeting again. Here he learned all these 10 verses. And you know what? How many had learned them? None. Some had learned some, but none had learned all 10. And Doss said right then, he learned his first lesson about Christians. Too often, how lack of wholeheartedness there is in their lives. Lack of commitment. They just don't follow through too often. And this spoke to Doss even before he knew the Lord. Well, he says, you know, another principle, you find a good horse and you work him to death. So they gave him 10 more verses to memorize, this time on the Christian life. Because he'd won a lot of points for his side, you know, and so he had to keep it up. The third week, he was on his way to work with lunch pail in hand, and he was reviewing these verses. And he got down to John 5:24. "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on him that sent me hath everlasting life, shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death into life." And he says he stopped right in the middle of the sidewalk there, and he says, "Have eternal life. Man, that's terrific. I want that." And then another verse came to mind he'd memorized, John 1:12. "But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name." And he says, "Lord, whatever it means to receive you, I do that right now. I receive you." And he said, he didn't know what happened, but something happened. And of course, you know what happened, because I trust every one of you have experienced meeting Jesus Christ in a personal way like this too. He said he got to the work and he said things were different. The old dirty stories just didn't seem funny anymore. There was a change that had taken place in his life. And so he remembered about the next day that there was a little group that would meet once a week with kind of a lay preacher at a noonday lunch, little Bible study type thing. The men would all sit outdoors and eat their lunches out in California, you know, all year round. So Doss says, "Hey, you know, there's that little preacher. We used to kind of make fun of him out there with his little handful of guys. But he says, look, I'm one of them now." So here comes Wednesday. He says, "I better go and talk to him." So he went over and he says, "Look, you know, I'm one of you guys now." He says, "Yeah, I met the Lord just the other day." He told this little preacher about it. The guy says, "Well, that's great." He says, "Why don't you why don't you just tell the men about it next week? Okay? And so Doss made the mistake of telling one of his buddies about it, that he was going to share what had happened in his life next week. Now, this is a lumber yard of about 200 men. It's a great big thing. And so come next Wednesday, all over the lumber yard on the bulletin boards, they call him Pork. I guess his hair kind of stood up. Porky? He says, come on out, Pork's going to preach. And instead of your handful of guys, there were about 200 men there. So Doss got a good introduction to the Christian life of sharing what Christ had done for him in this lumberyard to these men. Well, then he went to the pastor of this church. He says, look, he says, I know the Lord now, and he's doing some wonderful things for me. I want to serve him. What can I do? So the pastor says, well, look, he says, you know, we got a Sunday school in this church. And he said, there's a group of junior high boys, and they've killed off two teachers. He says, maybe you can do something with them. And so Doss took them, and you know, sure enough, there were six of them. Sure enough, it was a medlem that Sunday. He couldn't, you know, really get a message across at all. And there was one particular guy that was the leader of this thing. And so Doss prayed. He says, Lord, after Sunday, he says, Lord, you made little boys. You know what makes them tick. Give me some ideas of how to reach these kids. He got an idea. Go to that guy that's smarting off in the ringleader. So he went to him personally, visited him during the week. And I don't know if this is good psychology or not, but it worked in this case. He says, you know, he says, Satan didn't even have to be in Sunday school last Sunday. Why? Because you took his place. You kept the kids from hearing the message. But anyhow, he kind of won this kid's heart and confidence. Maybe just the fact that no teacher had ever visited him before. And here's a new teacher, the very first week after he's taken the class, he's visiting him. And there's another principle, get people on a one-to-one basis, say. And you can get a lot farther than trying to deal with them in a group. Well, he got the cooperation of this kid. And within a matter of a few weeks, all six of these kids came to Christ. And they started inviting their buddies in. And this thing grew in the Sunday school. And I don't know how large it grew, but it grew so this church couldn't hold it all. And they started then Bible classes for junior high kids. And in this town, there were about 225, 250 of these kids in the period of 3 years or so that came to Christ. And it was having a profound effect on this town. Some of the amusements areas and all that were having some problems with the kids, the schools were having some discipline problems, these things started to clear up because these kids were finding Christ. And these were days when Dawson had a real heart for God. Well, he always did, but for instance, he learned a verse a day for the first 3 years of his life. And not just learn them, but learn them so he could keep them. There were subjects that would come up that he didn't know the answers to. And so what he'd do, he'd search the scriptures, get his concordance out, look up all the scriptures on the subject, and say, take about 20 or 30 of the key verses and memorize them. This is the way he learned his doctrine. And this is one of the principles that the navigators use even today. Personal investigation. The way you find out what the scriptures teach on any subject is find out what the whole scriptures teach on that subject. And you can come up with your own conclusions. You don't, and now it's good to get some commentaries and all of this, but you don't have to just bank on what Dr. So-and-so says. The Holy Spirit can help us. If we investigate the word, we can come up with them with the right answers. Now, Charlie mentioned some of these things and how they develop. Well, for instance, let me tell you, you know this ladder on the Bible. How to find the, I don't know if you have ladders in your Bibles in Iowa, do you? In Indiana? Well, anyhow, you can find places quickly in the Bible. Well, Doss had these junior high Bible classes. Well, the kids couldn't find their way around their New Testament, so he developed this little system of laddering the Bible so they could find them quicker. And we use that today. They had another little thing when I first came in, too, they were using. It was called not only a laddered testament, but an arrowed testament. And I don't have a testament here, but you'd flip the thing like this. And Doss had a pencil. He'd take the rubber part of the pencil, cut it, and make an arrow out of it. And he uses a rubber stamp. And like he had a 10 points of the gospel at that time that he was using. And he would take these 10 arrows, and so he'd open it up and make the arrow so the arrow would point in here and make a red line over here to like verse 23, Romans 3:23. All right, the kid only had to go down, arrow 1, arrow 2 was Romans 6:23, and on down, and he could share the gospel this way, arrow New Testament. those went out of style, you know, many years ago, but these were things that the DOS worked up to help these kids come to Christ. The wheel was mentioned. Well, actually, the wheel started with a three-legged stool. DOS used the illustration of he'd heard of a three-legged stool. So he developed a three-legged stool, and he had the three legs of the word, prayer, and witness scene. And he used this for quite a while. But then he thought, you know, there are a lot of people that have these things, but there's still something missing. And he said, anyway, a stool, you know, is too much, connotes too much sitting down in a Christian life. He didn't like that. DOS was like dynamics and motion. So he developed the wheel. Christ is the center, and of course the four spokes. And he had the word, prayer, witnessing. And over here he added the third dimension. He didn't know how to do it, or the fourth. He called it living the life. That's kind of a vague term, but to DOS that meant something. Living the life. And not only these static things, but really living it. Well, this carried on for a number of years. When I first came in the high school work, we had that. In about 1940, 41, or 2 in that area, this began to crystallize and it became obedience. For one thing, the printers had a hard time getting all that into the spoke. So they came down to obedience. And that was the fourth spoke for a long time. Then some of us were kind of concerned that obedience was very definitely a part of the Christian life, but it somehow didn't fit it. Here you were matching apples and oranges. And so in 68, we finally got the obedient Christian in action. The word, prayer, and fellowship became the fourth spoke. Fellowship with other Christians and then your witness. This is your witness with and among believers, and your witness to unbelievers, and so forth. So you see, there's a little bit of evolution to this thing. I don't know if there's going to be any more changes in that or not, but there have been changes over the years. But this all started DOS meeting a need in the lives of these high school kids, or junior high kids. Well, we could go on with others. You mentioned the hand, the five ways of getting to know the word. That came out of a seminar study for the Bible clubs of the high school fellows and girls clubs. We can go into that a little later. All right. DOS then became active in these youth groups. And Christian Endeavor was called the organization's name that was involved with various churches throughout Southern California. It was an interdenominational thing. And DOS became, I think, deputation secretary for this for Southern California. Well, he didn't know what he was supposed to do. But he looked up somehow in the job description they had in the book that gave him, and it told about they're supposed to have gospel teams. He'd never heard about gospel teams. What are those? So, that's my job. I better have some gospel teams. So he developed this, and he got young people involved in holding meetings and all in churches all around Southern California. Then, in 1929, he felt he needed a little more training. So he took a year and went to the Los Angeles Baptist Theological Seminary. And he kept up his clubs. He had these clubs going throughout Southern California. But Greek took too much time, and so he quit after 1 year. He couldn't keep up the Greek and all these clubs and everything else. But it's interesting, out of that seminary experience, I don't know, this is getting back in ancient history for some of you too, but one of his profs was Dr. Charles E. Fuller, the founder of the old-fashioned revival hour of years ago, which is now the Joyful Sound. But this, of course, immediately established a relationship that later in years, and especially during the war years, really paid off, a cooperation with Charles Fuller and his work. Well, then, he didn't like the Greek because it was tying him up too much. So in 1930, a year later, he went to the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. He didn't have to have Greek there. And he was president of the Student Missionary Union. And it was at that time that God spoke to his heart about going to India. And he volunteered to go to India. Well, he had this heart condition, and I don't know what else, but it just didn't seem that God opened the door to India. But he prayed, Lord, if I can't go, let me be the means of sending many others to countries of the world. And all during these years, DOS was out of his mind on two things: personal evangelism and scripture memory. And he pushed these. There's quite an evolution to the way the topic of memory system developed too. He had a a group of 105 verses to start with. And, you know, you give a guy a pack of 105 sink or swim type thing. And then this didn't work too well. And it's refined in many different ways. But he was convinced that scripture memory could do for a person what it did for him and to prepare him to live the godly life and the spirit-filled life. And he was always pushing that and personal evangelism. Doss was a real witness. And he used all kinds of opportunities to witness. For instance, he had his motorcycle. He'd pick up a hitchhiker, get on the back of his motorcycle and witness to him over his shoulder. This kind of a thing. You know, that's not the best psychology, like the barber who's strapping up and says, "Are you prepared for eternity?" You know, it's not the best psychology. But Doss used to use this type of thing. He'd pick up hitchhikers, witness to them. He committed for a number of years there to witness to a soul a day. And I can remember him telling how sometimes he'd come back from some of these club beat, you know, and he was still in school at this time, and he just getting ready to go to bed, and he remembered he hadn't witnessed anyone. All right, what would you do? Doss put his clothes back up and went out on the street and tackled the first guy. I mean, this type of a thing. This is a commitment. He was a disciplined man. He wouldn't let himself get by with less than the best. Well, then in 1931, he only went 1 year there, and then he dropped out. It kind of slowed him down, too. So, 1931, he met with a fellow by the name of Walt, and they spent 42 days praying up in the hills there of Southern California. And they would meet at 5 o'clock every morning for prayer. They'd drive their motorcycles up. They had a little place in a ravine there where they kind of could hide and keep out of the weather, prayer lists and maps and things, and they prayed. And on Sunday mornings, they'd meet at 4 o'clock. And they'd pray for a couple of hours and read the Word and then head off to work. And at this time, God began to unfold more to him, promises from his word. And as they begin to pray for Southern California, the state of California, then all the states in the U.S., they begin to go to other countries. And finally, Dawson said they'd covered the whole world. They had a world map. And there wasn't much more to pray for and claim some promises. And so he says the burden was lifted, and they quit after 42 days of this. And then Dawson got laid up on his back. He got sick. And it was in this time in bed while he was thinking, he developed a plan called the Minutemen. And this was a kind of a gospel team concept of men who were committed to 9 disciplines. And some of them were like a verse a day, a soul a day, an hour a day with God, etc., etc. These 9 disciplines. And these fellows would meet, and then they went to churches and ministered throughout Southern California. This went on for about a year and a half, and gradually this group disbanded. Some went to seminary, some got married and went back to Podunk, or, you know, this type of thing, and it just kind of broke up. And Doss found himself praying. He wrote in the margin of his Bible, "Lord, bring me into contact with a band of men, strong, rugged soldiers of the cross, with an eye single to thy glory." And after he'd been praying that for a few weeks, a lady, a Christian lady who knew Dawson, said, "Dawson, here's the name and address of a Christian sailor, Les Spencer. And Les knows the Lord. He joined the Navy in order to save money to go to seminary." Now, we're getting into the Depression years now, when, you know, money was real hard to come by. And he says he's finding it hard living the Christian life on board his ship, and he's hoping for some help. So Doss, you could cable the ships out in the harbor there, and Spencer, meet me at the landing such and such a time and place. And so they got together, and they drove up on the hill overlooking the harbor and Doss's little old Model T Ford, and they were sitting there talking. Here, Dawson, this young sailor. And a cop came by, stuck his head in the window and says, "Okay, guys, where's the bottle?" Just remember, it's prohibition. You weren't supposed to have the bottle. Because if you saw a sailor and a guy sitting, you know there was a bottle somewhere. Dawson says, "No, we don't have any bottle here." He says, "We're just reading the Bible and talking and praying together and talking about the Christian life." And this cop says, "You know, that's funny, because I've been seeking God here for the last several weeks. I've been going to different churches and all. And I just can't get through. I can't find the answer, and I think the Bible's got it. Maybe you can help me." It was beginning to get dark. He says, "I got the key over here to a schoolhouse right nearby." So they went over there. And Dawson, of course, who had had the experience and the training through scripture memory and through witnessing, knew how to lead people to Christ. And so here he answered this cop's questions, led him to Christ. And this young sailor was watching and observing the whole thing. And after it was over, Les said to Doss, he said, "Doss, you know, I'd give my right arm if I could do what you did tonight, lead another person to Christ. I'm trying to witness, but it's not being very effective, and I don't really know how to lead people to Christ like that." Well, Doss said, "It isn't going to cost you your right arm, Les, but it will cost you something. It'll cost you some discipline, some time in the words, some scripture memory, prayer, and these things." And so when the ships were in, Les would come to Doss's house. And Doss taught him these basics of how to live and grow in the Christian life and how to reach out. And he said, "Look, Les, rather than just try to reach guys on the ship, pray for one man. That God will give you one man." So a few weeks later, here came old Les Spencer with a guy in tow, Gurney Harris. He says, "Doss, here's Gurney. Gurney's found the Lord." He says, "Teach him what you've taught me." And of course, this was a key that Doss did not really, I don't think, realize the significance of at the time. But he said, "No, I won't teach him. You teach him. If you can't teach him what I've taught you, then I have failed." And this was in, the first meeting with Les Spencer was in April of 1933. And this is where we date, really, the beginning of the Navigator's work, 1933. And it started with Les Spencer, then sharing with Gurney Harris. Les was a halfback on the football team of the USS West Virginia, this battleship. Gurney Harris was a 50-yard swimming champion of the Navy. And naturally, Gurney reached the guy on the swim team, the 440-yard swimming champ, Ed Goodrick. And this began to grow. Ed Goodrick reached John Dedrick, another fellow on the swim team. And Dedrick then reached Virgil Hook. Virgil Hook, by the way, was a guy that contacted Jim Downing. Jim Downing was number 6. And it's interesting to see how God led these different men. Les Spencer, when his time was up, he got out, went on to school and seminary, and he became up until just very recently, and I think he's got some other position, but he's been the director of the American Sunday School Union for a number of years, for many years. And that is it's an organization that starts rural Sunday schools throughout the whole United States in rural areas, and then churches begin from this. Gurney Harris, since 1940, has been a missionary to the Congo with the Africa Inland Mission. And when the missionaries were kicked out, you know, back when Congo got its independence, Gurney was one of several who were invited back by the Congolese. Not all were, but he was one of them. He's back there today. Ed Goodrick, or John Dedrick, he's been with the Wycliffe Translators. And a wonderful thing, just this last year, he's been translating the scriptures. Well, he's been reducing the language of the Yaqui Indians in Mexico to writing, translating the scriptures, and they have just completed and printed the whole New Testament in the Yaqui Indian language. And they had the dedication of it just this last year. And Ed Goodrick, he's a professor of Bible and Greek at the Multnomah School of the Bible in Portland, Oregon. Virgil Hook, he was with the China Inland Mission, a missionary on the borders of Tibet. And of course, he was kicked out when the communists took over, and he is on Taiwan with the Overseas Missionary Fellowship, which is of the China Inland Mission group. And then, of course, Jim Downing. Jim was the first one of these early navigators that got the burden to stay in the Navy as the mission field. And he stayed in, and God used Jim in a wonderful way until 56. He got he retired from the Navy, and he's been with the navigators ever since. And, of course, this thing spread out. And it spread out so that on board this one ship alone, in the course of 3 or 4 years, about 125 men found Christ. And they were men that not only knew the Lord, but were able to lead others to Christ. And they had gospel teams from this ship that would go into the churches throughout Southern California. They dubbed this the floating seminary because there were so many Christians on board this ship. And these fellows, of course, one by one, began to get transferred to other ships. And a witness would start up here, and another one, and another one, and the work began to grow. And then, of course, World War II started in Pearl Harbor. All these major ships were sunk. And it's interesting that without exception, well, there's one exception of a guy who had been tied in with the Navigator fellows but was living in a backslidden condition. I don't know if, you know, just exactly you can say that's God's judgment, but he was the only one that lost his life of these early navigators at Pearl Harbor. They were all scattered and throughout other ships, because these ships were on the bottom of the bay out there. And then, of course, thousands of others came in through the draft and all during World War II. And God used, really, these navigator fellows and the navigator ministry to reach thousands, tens of thousands of men for Christ during World War II. And, of course, the navigators weren't the only ones that were working with people. But we were one of the ones that was having a most significant influence in the service. Not only the Navy, Air Force, Army, etc. I got involved then in the Air Force during World War II and was very closely involved with the navigators. In 1935, backing up here a little bit, these sailors made a trip. There were about five or six of them with Dawson that made this trip back through the Midwest and the East, visiting these people's hometown, these fellows' hometown home churches, and visiting some of the Christian colleges and all. And so they said, tell us who's coming. Who's coming? They called themselves, in those days, I don't know the exact term, I didn't look it up, but something like Servicemen's Bible Class or Club or something like this. So they came up, tell them the navigators are coming. Because they were men from the Navy, and that's where the first term was really dubbed there into the navigators in 35. And the motto, to know Christ and to make him known, was adopted then. All right. In addition to the work with the servicemen, there were high school. Now the junior high work, by the way, when the work with the servicemen started, the junior high work really dropped. But there were high school young fellas, particularly in the Southern California area, that saw what was happening with these sailors. And they came to Doss and says, Doss, you know, give us some help in the same line. But Doss was too busy with the sailors. But then the fleet moved to the East Coast. And so Doss said to the men, he said, look, shall I pull up here and go back and meet you on the East Coast? They'd be back there for a number of weeks or a few months. Or should I stay here and give these high school kids some help? And the sailors said, you stay here and give the high school kids the help. We'll carry on over there in the East Coast. So he started, Doss started then what he called the high school Bible clubs, Dunamis, were the fellows clubs, and later on, Martyrs, not the kind you think of, were the girls clubs. And these are two Greek words taken from Acts 1:8. But ye shall receive power, that was the fellows club, when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and ye shall be witnesses unto me. And Doss developed, and of course this is when I got involved in the high school clubs here. But Doss had a very creative mind, and he had this club thing worked out. We had notebooks, we had, with all kinds of materials, he had plans, and we implemented some of it, but of sweaters and emblems and you name it, he'd thought of them and thrown them more ideas away than most people ever thought of. Because it just didn't fit the bill or do the job that he wanted to do. But this work grew throughout Southern California. And we used to have our weekly club meetings, and then we'd have rallies together. The fellows and girls clubs were separate, but we'd have rallies together. There were conferences and this type of thing. Then, just before we got involved in the war, two things happened. One thing happened. Collier's Magazine. I don't know, you ever hear of Collier's? They went out of business before most of you can remember. It was like the Saturday Evening Post. Those were the two weekly magazines. Well, Collier's saw that, war had already started in Europe, and we were more or less getting involved, and people were getting into the draft had begun, I think. So they said, they sent a reporter to find out about the spiritual life of things in the Navy, of the men in the Navy. So this reporter from Collier's went on the flagship, the USS California, which was the flagship of the Navy, to the head chaplain and said, look, I've got the assignment to find out what the spiritual condition is of our men, what the situation is. The chaplain says, don't go to me, go to Orrin Bell, this navigator guy. He says, he'll tell you what's going on about the men. So Orrin Bell was a very interesting guy. He was the light heavyweight boxing champion of the Navy and had never been defeated, found Christ, and after a while he gave up the boxing racket, but he was an unusual fellow. And so this guy interviewed Orrin Bell, and here this Collier's, this nationwide magazine, produced this article called Onward Christian Sailors. And it had pictures of Dawson and the whole work. This kind of put the Navigators on the map as far as general publicity is concerned, just before World War II broke out. And then after the war broke out, Charles Fuller of the Old Fashioned Revival Hour, I mentioned before, he had this worldwide ministry of the gospel and a very definite ministry among servicemen. And people would write their, you know, they're going in the service. And so Charles Fuller turned over all his contacts to Dawson, the Navigators, to visit on the camps and the bases and all of this. So there was a good coordination there too. But this thing spread out during the, so that by the end of the war, we had contact with men that we were helping on roughly 1,000 ships in the Navy and about 1,000 Army camps and air bases throughout the world, where at least one man and many times as many as 50 or 60 men who could, you know, were growing for Christ and knew how to lead others to Christ. But there was something happening at the end of World War II. Doss made a trip out to Hawaii where there was much going on, and he was disheartened. Now, they had Bible classes going out there that wouldn't quit out on the islands. You know, you get the numbers. They were astronomical of people in Bible classes. But he found this, that we were trying to do the work mass production. You get a bunch of people, like here, there'd be Bible classes of this size. And some of these men, outstanding Bible teachers had developed among these men, were teaching these fellows. And they were learning, and here'd be another class. But this personal touch, this man-to-man thing, was kind of being left in the background. And so Doss came back just before the end of World War II from the Hawaii, and instead of being elated, which a lot of people would be for all that was happening, he was a little disheartened. And he started emphasizing again this man-to-man approach, help one, train one. The thing that was the key to the development of the Navs in the early days. After the war, there was a real time of transition from about, it didn't happen right away, but say from about 46 to about 49. That was a real transition period for the Navigators. Because most of the guys had got discharged. They were going back home to their hometowns, going to college. And it was the work dwindled in numbers, although there was still quite a few in the service, of course. But it was a real financial crisis time because these men who were making money from the military and were helping in the work were no longer able to. They were in college and didn't have much in those days. And so this was a real transition in many ways. And I can remember the Doss and the Navs trying to support themselves in many ways, wondering what God was trying to do. Well, maybe it's just I can just point out here a little bit about the philosophy of the Navigators as far as finances are concerned. The Navigators was founded on what you might call the Hudson Taylor, George Mueller principles. These things had a profound effect in Doss's life as a young Christian. He'd read these books and all, and how these men believed God. They didn't tell anybody about their needs. They just told God, and God miraculously supplied. And this is the way the Navigators work was up until the end of World War II. You couldn't even get Doss to tell you if we had any needs. He wouldn't tell you because he thought it was unspiritual to tell. And so naturally, here we're in a period of real crisis, and what's God trying to teach us here? So he got some ideas. You know, Paul, he was in tent making, so we got some tent making project. I remember we had some of our guys that had electronic experience opened up the reliable radio repair. Another deal opened up a sign business for making signs, and there was a rubber-based paint company that was trying to get our guys involved. And you name it, I could name you a lot of things we got involved in to try to help support the work. And none of them ever panned out. Oh, they'd go for a little while. Well, Rod Sargent was a salesman for the Western States for one of the leading Christian publishers. And this is how he got his start. But God's hand just wasn't in this somehow. And then down in around 49 or 50 in here, I'm not sure exactly the date, but we had to do something because the work would get in a crisis financially, and some guy would get the burden on his heart. He'd been putting a nest egg away somewhere, a few thousand dollars, and he'd kick it in. I mean, he wasn't asked to, but God just laid it on his heart. And this would get us over a hump for another, you know, few months or so. And this is what happened in those years. But it really wasn't the answer. So, Dawson and Lila were studying the scriptures. And you remember how God fed the prophet Elijah? You remember? How'd God feed Elijah when he was out in the ravine out there? All right, God sent a raven every day to bring him some food, didn't he? That's kind of George Mueller Hudson Taylor principle. And by the way, I could tell you some war stories of how God really supplied it. This was so typical, I'll make a parenthesis here, of the Austin and Av work. In the early days, when I remember one time Doss was going out with a guy that was a little bit skeptical, a Christian, but they were going out to one of the clubs, and they were just about to run out of gas. The old car sputtered, and they pulled up into a gas station. And Doss says, "Hey, we don't have enough gas to get to the club." He says, "I don't have any money." The guy had some money, and he said, "Hey, boy, sure a good thing for you I'm along, you know." Doss says, "Keep your money. You'll see what God will do, you know." So they started looking around the car. They looked under the seat, and they found, I guess, about 35, 40 cents. And they bought enough gas to get to the club, you know. And it's, you know, well, this is one of the ways God provides. Another time, Doss, I remember, was when he was at Biola. He had to go out to his clubs, and he had to catch the Pacific Electric train that would run out. It was 50 cents round trip, and he says, "Boy, I don't have the money, but I better get going. I better prepare myself because I have to be down there in about 15 minutes. So he raced out of the building around the corner, and he bumped into a man called Daddy Horton. No, Daddy Hale, because I knew him too before he died. Dear godly man, you know, and he grabbed Dawson by the coat and said, "Where are you going?" Dawson says, "Hey, I have to hurry and catch the train, you know." And as he let him go, he felt something in his pocket. He says he didn't dare look until he got to the train station. But there he is. Daddy Hale had dropped 50 cents into his pocket. He was on his way to catch the train, you know. Or 30 sailors would converge on the house. You know, the ships would be in. And here they are. You'd had a meeting that night. And they're all decked all over the floor and the sofas and everything else, sleeping. And you got to feed them in the morning. So what do you do? They didn't have enough food or enough money. Well, it so happened that a milk truck broke down, a little catacorner across the street there, and the guy knocked on the door the next morning and says, "Look, they can't get a delivery, they can't get a tow truck over to pick me up until this afternoon. The milk will spoil, as before real refrigeration time. Can you use some of this?" You know, and this type of thing, this was the normal routine. And I could really tell you story after story like this. But then, suddenly, back here, these things kind of ceased, at least to that degree and extent. What's God trying to teach us here? So as Doss and Lila were studying the scriptures, they saw how God fed Elijah. But you know, that isn't the only way God fed Elijah. Do you remember what God also told Elijah after that? You remember the story? Somebody's, what is it?
Where he went to that woman's house.
All right. Go to that widow and ask her for her last bit of meal. Now look at, this is not the George Mueller, Hudson Taylor principle. But, you know, and this is the thing that Doss had a hard time learning, but he learned it well. That God is not stereotyped or stuck in a rut. He cannot deal only one way. And this is a tendency so often with George Mueller or Hudson Taylor. God used them to set an example of what he could do and can do. But some will take that principle and say, this is the only way God works. And you're unspiritual if you don't do it this way. Well, God has much more variety than that. He's much more creative. And so here he told him to go to this woman. And of course, you know, they went and she fixed the last bit of meal for him, and then it told the cruse of oil never failed from then on. Remember the story? Well, there was a widow, by the way, the same thing, that knew Doss and Lila very well. A wealthy widow. But she'd never given to the work. And so Doss and Lila felt led to go to her and talk to her. And they went and they shared what God had been doing and teaching them and shared some needs of the navigators. And this woman, tears started coming down her face. Cheeks. "Well, did we offend you? We're sorry." "Oh, no," she said. "These are tears of joy." She says, "I thought that you were being supported by," and she named a foundation and so forth. "I didn't know you had a need. I'm just thrilled to know that I can have a part." And So this was a kind of a confirmation to at least make the needs known. And of course, there's a whole process of evolution in this up until today, but God seems to have honored our making our needs known. And by the way, we're going to be going into a national fund drive here next year. We find that we have to do this about every 7 to 10 years, a major fund drive, and we're in a need right now. You'll be hearing more about that. But, you know, so God has led us this way, and God is honored in this way, and in raising finances. But it all happened back in these years where it was a rough transition, and other things were a transition too. I better hurry on here. All right, let me give you a few other dates here. All right, in 1951, I better erase some of this stuff. In 1951, I'll put 51. This was the year that Billy Graham called Dawson and said, "Dawson, you know, people are coming to Christ in our crusades, but a lot of them aren't going on." He said, "I'm prepared even to quit evangelism if we can't do more, to follow these people up and help them grow. And you've had success in this area of seeing disciples raised up. Help us." And of course, Dawson says, I can't. I'm too busy. I just don't have any time." Billy says, "Okay, come down and observe." Billy's a good psychologist too, by the way. "Come just observe." And of course, when Doss got down there and got his feet wet, he saw what could be done. But it's interesting too, to show Doss. Dawson generally didn't have much use for mass evangelism. He'd seen too much of the slipshod way of doing things. He was strong in personal evangelism, but he had little or no use for mass evangelism. But he knew God was blessing Billy. And Dawson, before Billy ever called him, had a plan all worked out of how he would handle training, follow-up for mass evangelism if he were ever given the opportunity. And so he had the plan all worked out. And, of course, this is these years. Then he got his feet wet. And from then on, for about 5 years, he gave half his time to the Graham Crusade, got Lauren involved. And we trained Charlie Riggs and all these others, or NAV fellows, who are doing the work now today of following up. And this has been done for other evangelists. In 53, we purchased Glen Eyrie. And you know the story, I think, on Glen Eyrie. We won't go into that, how God gave us this place here. 56, Dawson died. And you know how he died, I think, don't you? Scroon Lake, thrown out of the boat with a girl that couldn't swim, held her up. And Jack Wurtson, who was the Word of Life Hour, was driving the boat, came back. Dawson had drowned. All right. Lauren Sanney became president here. All right, about 58 and 59, Lauren appointed Leroy Imes as U.S. director for the U.S. ministry. And God used Leroy to implement some basic changes. For instance, we have been involved here in these earlier years with other works. This was one of the things that God gave to Dawson, a relationship with Christian leaders that was unusual and unique. You know, I could just name them: of Youth for Christ, Tory Johnston, Dr. Bob Cook, Dave Morgan, Overseas Crusades, Dick Hillis, Billy Graham himself, Campus Crusade for Christ, Bill Bright, the Wycliffe Bible Translators. He was on the board of directors there and had a profound World Vision, Bob Pierce, Missionary Aviation Fellowship. Dawson allowed it to be started in our own offices and provided the personnel for it. The Moody Institute of Science, Dr. Irwin Moon. Well, this dates way back. Dawson and Lila worked in his church and lived together with Irwin and had an influence there. Greater Europe Mission, Dr. Bob Evans. Dawson had this ministry with Christian leaders that was unique. There's no question about it. Now, Lauren does not have those gifts that Doss had in that area. But as a result of this, we were involved in other works. And this was our first thrust. God used Youth for Christ, Overseas Crusades, World Vision, all these other organizations to get the NAVs thrust out. And we were working with them, helping them in follow-up. We were kind of their follow-up experts. We were helping. People were coming to the Lord all over the place. And so we were helping them. But we kind of found down here that we were following up everybody else's babes, and we weren't having a whole lot of babes of our own. So God used Leroy to reemphasize evangelism, our own, win our own, grow our own. And also, God used Leroy to develop the idea of a team concept. rather than an individual. Boy, like when I went out to Germany to start the work in Germany. I didn't know where I was going to lay my head when I went out there. One guy, you know, and you bat your head against the wall, and God blesses and gives some fruit, but we don't go into countries that way anymore. You know, you learn some things the hard way. Team concept. Leroy began to use the home as a base of operations out from which you minister. In the earlier days, the home was the center of ministry primarily. And these things, God used Leroy to develop a lot of these things. Then in 1961, was a very strategic year, we had our first what we call Overseas Policy Conference. And it was at that time that three major decisions were made. One, that the navigators would fly their own flag now. In other words, we wouldn't just be going out under everybody else's organization. Not that we were against helping others, and we still have and do, but in other words, we're going to go out and do our own thing. Because we found that in these other contexts, it was difficult to do our own thing the way we really wanted to. Because we were just busy in their program too much, doing a good job, but not seeing this generation spiritual reproduction taking place the way we wanted. Secondly, we began to define the objectives of the navigators. Lauren, God used Lauren for this. Now, Doss was great. Doss was a man of tremendous vision. But Doss did not have a handle on these things often to pass on to someone. For instance, our first years over in Europe, I remember we'd been batting our heads there and winning a few and training them. And Doss came back after about 2 years, and so we had a little conference in Paris, I remember, and said, now, Doss, tell us now, just what really is our objective? Now, what are the thing we're really after? It was kind of vague and nebulous in those days. Well, Doss says, let's just see some first century Christianity. Well, to him, that said something, but it's hard to get a handle on that, you know. Well, God used Lauren to kind of define our objectives. And then thirdly, to demonstrate the navigator vision. Not to talk about it, not to preach on it, but to demonstrate it. And that took place in 1961. Those decisions. And God has honored those decisions in the ensuing years. And of course, today, let me just summarize here. Today, we have a staff of between 900 and 1,000 full-time workers throughout the world. And we're working in 28 countries and 24 nationalities involved. Now, right now, today, yet, the Americans are still predominant in number. But every year, the proportion is reducing. And there's going to come a year down the line here where the Americans are going to be actually in a minority. It's going to take a while, but it's going to happen because God is prospering the ministry throughout the world and other nationals are coming up. And this is a multinational organization. And only God can hold a thing like this together because there are cultural ramifications and everything else. But if we keep our noses in the book and keep walking with God, He's got to control the thing. Because, you know, humanly speaking, it could be a big monstrosity before we know it. Because spiritual multiplication is beginning to pay off. We just can't keep up with it. Our headquarters office is just growing by leaps and bounds here to try to keep up with the work that's going on out there. And we can tell you a lot about that. Well, let me just summarize a few principles here about Dawson and the navigators, and then you fire some questions. Doss is a man that had a heart for God. He saw a tremendous contrast in his early Christian life of what he read in the Bible and what he saw in nominal Christianity. God calls for excellence, but he saw mediocrity everywhere he looked among Christians in general. There is, of course, some good notable exceptions. Doss was a man of prayer and a man of faith. He spent hours with God in the Word and claiming promises, and many of these out of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 43 and 48, and these whole areas. We won't have time to go into those specific promises that God gave to Doss to claim. And we're seeing fulfilled today throughout the world. Dawson was a very disciplined man. He had a lot of drive, but it was under, I believe, the Holy Spirit's control. I mentioned some of the things. Well, like the drive. He'd come back from some of these clubs, and his goal was a verse a day, to learn a verse a day. And he'd come in, you know, just the idea that he hadn't witnessed to someone. I didn't learn my verse today. So he would walk the opposite direction from home until he got it memorized to to discipline himself to do what he knew he should do. He found that by nature we're all pretty slothful. I'm in that boat, and I imagine you are too. And we need some disciplines, not self-discipline, but under the Spirit's control, based on what we find in the Scriptures. And this comes from spending time with God. He was a very practical man. He was so practical often that it hurt. You know, you couldn't get by with generalities with Dawson, a vague generality. Some people you can bluff. You can't bluff. Couldn't bluff Dawson. You know, what do you mean by that? Give me an example, you know. And you're right down to where it hurts. He was a tremendous guy for challenging people, but not only challenging, I think God used him in a unique way to develop the how. How to pray, how to witness, how to memorize Scripture. And this put a handle on things to help Christians. You know, Christians have been challenged to death from the beginning of the church, no doubt. You hear a sermon every Sunday, there might be a tremendous challenge. But so often, the how is lacking. You go out on cloud nine, and in next week, you're down looking up often. This is the case. But God used us to develop some of the practical hows. Doss was interested in individuals. He spent a lot of time with people. He prayed that God would use him to make a significant difference, an impact in lives. And I won't have the time, but I can tell you some interesting stories that I know of personally and have met of people who spent an hour or two with Doss. That's all they ever knew, and their lives were changed because of it. He asked God to use him in this way. He was generous. He would give to others. You know, like here, remember Dick Hillis got kicked out of China, you know, and so he comes and he was visiting Dawson. Dawson opened up his wardrobe, help yourself, you know. You like this suit? You like this tie or whatever? You know, he's just generous. And, of course, God gave to him generously, too. Of course, the key of the NAV vision was a spiritual reproduction, multiplying. And we call it today multiplying disciples, spiritual multiplication. And we're seeing the effects of it today. I could say many more things, but our time is gone. Why don't you shoot some questions, maybe? Yeah?
Those two school teachers, Ms. Bilt and Ms. Thomas, did they ever live long enough to see the great way God used them?
Oh, you bet they did. And Ms. Mills is still living. And by the way, Ms. Thomas died, I guess, 10 years ago, something like this. But Ms. Mills is still living, and she was very, very active, and is still active today. She's retired now. She's in her late 70s. But here, you know, this, I think his brochure, The Hard Way and all that came out. You know, we send her stuff, and man, she writes back. She's a witness. She wants to know how to witness more and give me more of some of that stuff I can pass out here and use. She's a very active person. I've known her down through the years, and whenever I'm in California, I always look her up. Yeah.
Do you have the date on the Colliers magazine?
I think it was 1940. Yeah. I don't know which month offhand, but you want to look it up in the library? Yeah, look it up. It'd be interesting. Onward Christian Sailors. I think it was the 1940, one of the months. I forget what month. Well, Doss married Lila Trotman, and I can't tell you really the year, but it was in here somewhere, 1930, 31, in that area. And, of course, he led Lila to the Lord. Lila was several years younger, and he used to take these high school kids, you know, and involved with the church and to take them to different activities and he'd have them share a verse of scripture before they leave the car and this kind of thing. Well, Lila was one that he led to the Lord one time and then married her later. And she was a real helpmeet. She's got a real testimony to hear of the experiences God gave them.
How many children do they have and where are they now?
Well, they had five children. One was not mentally right. He was an invalid up till about 14. I mean, he really, I don't know, the mentality, you know, was almost nil there. And God used this in their lives in an amazing way. He was the last one. And he died then at 14, but they cared for him many times. And Doss, you know, being the kind of a guy he was, a hard driver and everything, he had some rough edges. And God used this in his life to mellow him very definitely. And the other four, one of them is here in town, has a job with the postal service. His family here. Of course, Lila lives here in town. And the other three are out in California, married and have families. Somebody raised their hand here. Pardon? Oh, well, he was a practical joker, I'll tell you that. Yeah, you'd go to a meal at Doss's house, and of course, he always had this great big oak table there. There were always at least 18 people. That is in the later years at 509 Monterey Road, at least 18, normal. This was normal, there would be more. It was a big family, and there was all kinds of practical joking. Yeah, right.
Did he have a verse pack?
Verse pack? He's the guy that invented them. You bet he had verse packs.
Was required if the college work started?
Well, the college work really started after World War II, when the servicemen got discharged and started into college. That's where it started. And so we remained in contact with these fellows. And I remember, for instance... after the war at Bible Institute of Los Angeles, because our headquarters were right there in the same building until we moved here to Glen Eyrie. Of the student body, I think they must have had about 900 in the student body that time, and they asked at one particular time, I remember, how many, this is about 2 or 3 years after the war, how many had received Christ during the war years of the fellows? I think there were about 60-some that had received the Lord in the service who were there at Biola at that time. And they asked how, and it was quite interesting, that 40-some of them had come to the Lord through the Navigators, of those 60 at that particular time. And so that's just one school that we happen to know about. Any other questions?
Were there any people that, in particular, Doss got training or help or instruction from himself in your early years?
Well, yes. Dawson, he would seek out men that he felt, you know, had something to offer. One of them was Irwin Moon's father, Daddy Moon. Another was Charles Fuller. There were some others. And then, of course, Billy Graham, although Billy was younger, Doss had a tremendous respect for Billy. And I know Lauren has said, well, it's true that, you know, Doss has been a leader most of the time and never a follower. But Lauren says, look, I was on the Graham team for 5 years, and although Billy sought Doss's counsel on most decisions and all that he made, Billy was running that thing, and Dawson was a follower. And Lauren says, I saw Doss knows how to follow, too. But he could only follow one who had enough to challenge him, and Billy was one of them that would have this. He couldn't follow everybody, because he'd be too far ahead of them in many respects, many others.
When did Lauren Sandy come around?
Well, Lauren came in about 1940, and Dawson met him up at a conference up at Mount Hermon in Northern California. And it's quite an interesting way that it worked out. Lauren had found the Lord a year or so before, and he was made to direct this Bible conference of his particular church. Well, Dawson had been there with a Navigator group the week before, and he stayed over another week, and he saw Lauren up there, and he would get Lauren aside for little tips, you know. Dawson was always trying to help people, and this got on some people. But others who responded, it was good, and he would help Lauren on how to MC a meeting or lead singing or do these things. And then he says, hey, this was a favorite trick of Dawson's. Why don't we get together for some, you know, a little time of prayer or something? Great, great. You know what it was? 5 o'clock in the morning down at the creek. This was always the way Doss worked. Cliff Barrows was at that conference, and Cliff and Lauren both and all would got with Doss down at the creek in these days. And I remember when we were in these high school clubs, every Saturday morning, this was at 6 o'clock, there was a park right near Doss's home. And by the way, Doss just lived a block from my high school. This is how I got involved. One of the early Navs led me to Christ and got me in touch with Doss. Well, Doss would have this 6 o'clock time of prayer and reading the Word. And so he said, any of the kids, you want to come? Great. So my brother and I used to get on our bikes and ride about a mile and a half to this park. And we'd build a fire and get some wood and stuff. And Doss, we'd read the Word and we'd have an hour, hour and a half of time of prayer in the Word. But he was always meeting God early and inviting others and out early. This was one of Doss's hallmarks. Any other questions? Yeah?
As navigators grow and it gets larger, do you see any signs of maybe degeneration or lack of the initial fervency that Doss and Common turn into?
Well, let me say this, that in those early days, Dawson was a hard-driving kind of a guy, a real man's man type of a fella, you know. And he was this kind of a person. And not everybody responded to this, especially it was hard on some of the gals. Because Dawson was a hard hitter, see, and even with the gals he was quite a bit. Well, I think that this was of God to lay a good solid foundation, I really do. But I don't think that that was necessarily drive and this type of thing is necessarily good for the long haul for everyone. Now, the basic principles, you better keep the same. But I could give you illustrations that we have, I should say, moderated or tempered a little bit. The way I feel it is that God used Doss to lay this solid foundation. And often in laying a foundation, you have to be a little stricter in the foundation than some other parts, because if the foundation isn't good, the whole structure is weak. And so, you know, in any organization or movement, you never have any guarantee that things that the next generation is going to be exactly what the first generation was. The best you can do is just keep with the Lord and keep in the book. But there's no guarantee. Doctrinal error or anything, there's no guarantee. One generation cannot guarantee the next generation. But they can lay the guidelines for them to get in the book, claim the promises, walk with God. And these basics, see, that we emphasize, these are the things that will keep the movement on the right track. And if we ever forget the basics, then you know, it's only a matter of time the termites start eating away. But you've got to keep it the basics. And as long as we keep emphasizing the basics of walk with God, time in the Word, scripture memory, and these things...